Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dialect Coach's Corner podcast, the place where we love exploring language and the way people speak it. I'm Jerome Butler, your dialect coach. It's Father's Day down here in Hotlanta, the ATL, Dogwood City, Atlanta, GA, and I'm excited to have as my guest on the podcast another talented dialect coach, actress, educator, and lover of language. You've seen her work as a dialect coach in The Lucky Ones, Public Enemies, The Immigrant, Betrayal on NBC, Chicago Fire on ABC. She's a resident vocal coach and a performer with Greasy Joan and Company, whose work focuses on innovative presentations of classical work. She's performed with the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, the Festival de la Rue in Switzerland, as well as the Chicago Court, Red Moon, and Organic Touchtone Theaters. She's an assistant professor of voice at the University of Illinois Chicago and has coached the national tours of Billy Elliot, the musical and Dirty Dancing, and dozens of theatrical productions in Chicago. If we had a studio audience, they would be putting their hands together right now for Tanara Marshall. Welcome to the podcast, Tanara.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing down here in Atlanta.
I am coaching a film called Insurgent, and that is actually what I call Divergent 2. So it's the second in the trilogy of films based on the books Divergent.
Yes. And have you been doing long days? I mean, just a little bit of inside filmmaking stuff. Have you been doing long days?
Some days are long, some days are not. Because I only need to be there when anyone with an accent other than a North American one is talking. Yes. So I have a Brit and an Aussie and two more such coming in. So when they're on film and talking, I have to be there. But yes, it's an action film, so there are a lot of sequences where they're jumping off of trains and onto trains, so I don't have to be around. So there are 12-hour days, and there are no-hour days.
So it's
kind of nice. I have some time in Atlanta.
Well, of course, you know, when you're working 12 hours, everyone knows that filmmaking is glamorous. So
terribly.
It's exciting every moment.
Constantly. The grazing at the craft services table, the sitting in the hot sun, I can't say enough about it.
Yeah, we're talking a lot of inside baseball right now. How are you enjoying Atlanta? Is this your first time here?
It is my first time, and I actually quite love it. I love where I'm staying. I just love all the food I'm eating, and I love going to Piedmont Park. And I haven't really gotten out of Atlanta very much, but once I've gone hiking, but I look forward to doing some more.
Yes.
It's a great town.
So tell me about your work with Greasy Joan and Company. Is that the name of the group?
Greasy Joan actually disbanded not too long ago, but for many years we were making, as you mentioned, innovative classical work. And by that we simply meant we were interested in classical work, but we were interested, frankly, in the lesser known classical works. Mm-hmm. Sort of like what the Mint Theater does in New York City, their interest in the plays, the one or two plays that Shakespeare wrote that no one ever does, like Pericles.
Mm, I've done that play twice.
Well, see, we are brethren in many ways. And that was my first, really only major theater company that I was a member of. And that was a dear project for many, many years. And I started with them as an actor for hire. And then they asked me to join the company. And I did as an actor. And then I started coaching shows for us as well, shows that I was in or shows that I wasn't in. Mm-hmm. And then my career moved on, and we all sort of did, and the second, third generation of actors to take over the company took it over, and then they moved on, and it had a very typical lifespan for Chicago non-equity theaters.
So basically it sort of transformed into nothing.
Well, I like to think it did a lot while it was there, but yes, it sort of, it blossomed and then it faded.
Yeah, it ran its course.
It ran its course, and you know what? I think the funny thing and the enlightening thing is that that's really typical.
Yes,
isn't it? I mean, for theater companies to make it like Steppenwolf has, is actually the exception and not the rule.
Sure.
Statistically speaking.
Yeah, and you could say that that is something that is to be expected and speaks to the health of a theatrical community, as opposed to flogging an idea that once had vitality and perhaps doesn't anymore.
That's right. Or flogging an already overburdened theater-going public in Chicago. I mean, truly, there are so many plays going on at any one time. I don't know that there are enough people that go see theater that regularly to sustain all of it.
Yeah.
That's not to say that shouldn't happen. I'm just saying there aren't that many people.
We were talking the other day about your work documenting dialects of Native American tribes, English dialects. Tell me a little bit about that work.
Yeah, so I am very interested in the way that members of what we call Native American tribes or American Indian tribes speak English. I'm interested in that purely from the dialect coach's perspective, meaning how is that useful to me as somebody who's working with an actor who needs to acquire a realistic way of speaking for a character to portray. So I don't know much about the sort of structure of dialects as they pertain to the tribal language, the original language that that person may or may not speak, mm-hmm. or that that tribe belongs to. But I am very interested in both the similarities and differences between how the many tribes in mostly North America, but also Canada. Mm-hmm. Sorry, mostly the United States, but also Canada. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And how did you become interested in the work?
Well, you know, it was because I had to. I was working on a show, and I needed a sample of a Cherokee man speaking both English and speaking Cherokee, and there I couldn't find one. I didn't at the time have money to go to the Eastern Cherokee Nation, which is based in now North Carolina, mm-hmm. and go meet people. So I went to a website that many of us vocal coaches and dialect coaches go to, the International Dialects of English Archive, mm-hmm. run by our fabulous colleague Paul Meyer.
Yes.
Founded and maintained by Paul Meyer. And I'm sad to say there were no such samples there. So I needed to go get some. Now, as it happened, for the show that I happened to be coaching, which was a Robert Schenken play called The Kentucky Cycle, somebody that I knew in Chicago had done the show at their theater, and he actually had a Cherokee sample, which he was kind enough to give to me. Yeah. So I was kind of out of the woods for that. For that project,
yes.
But it got me thinking that there's a need. Surely, you know, there are plays written and yet to be written that will feature Native American characters that need to be represented fairly, as we do any other dialect of English. So that started a project that was sort of bolstered by my work at the university. Meaning, the university was very interested in me creating a path of research that was new.
Yes.
And so they gave me time and money to support some travel and the beginning of a collection. And I have to say, even though it's been a few years now since I've started this, it's been betwixt and between other projects of mine, so I haven't been able to collect as many samples as I'd like to, but this could be a lifelong project.
There's no way that it won't be.
There's a lot to do.
There's a lot to do.
There is. It's true. I mean, I'm limited only by my abilities and my lifespan because there's so many, right?
Yeah.
Hundreds, thousands.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure they're changing as all dialects do.
Indeed, they are.
How are some of the ways that the American Indian dialects differ from tribe to tribe, geographically?
What I've noticed so far is that dialects tend to be influenced, like all dialects in this country are, by geography. Mm-hmm. So a descendant of the Cherokee tribe, the Eastern Cherokee tribe, of course, now that the Cherokee tribe is sadly bifurcated, and the Eastern Cherokee tribe is here on the East Coast, and the brunt of the main Cherokee tribe now is in Oklahoma.
First of all, that I wasn't even aware of that.
Well, there you go. Information. Yeah, so of course, the history of their dialects is so tied, as with all cultures, to its history of the people. Mm-hmm. So the Eastern Cherokee, for instance, being that they tend to, well, they come from southern North Carolina, and of course there are actually some Georgia Eastern Cherokee as well, are very influenced by the kinds of sounds that other people in this part of the country are influenced by. I mean specifically Appalachian sounds. Mm. So I have heard some Eastern Cherokee tribe members speaking with what you might call a sort of twangy sound. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you closed your eyes and you pictured the speaker, you wouldn't picture a Native American person. That surprised me, only because I'm ignorant, not because I know anything. But to be honest, Jerome, what surprised me more and is continuing to surprise me is how similar tribes, people from tribes across the country sound.
Wow.
Not being from the same geographical location. For instance, I used to live in Alaska, which is one of the reasons that I became sort of aware of and interested in the Native American world. I lived in a Native village with my father and stepmother in the southwest of Alaska,
mm-hmm.
on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, very small village of then about 400 people, mostly Eskimo, some Athabaskan Indian. And now, mind you, it's not reservation country, right? That's
yes.
That's not part of that that state's experience. But I spent some time later in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, so in the southwest, and I was struck by how the Native American voices that I heard down there were similar to the ones that I heard way up in Alaska.
Hmm.
And they were, to me, quite distinct or specific to the sort of general Native American folks. So I thought, huh. And then as I've traveled to Montana and
yes.
and interviewed some folks in Chicago, I'm hearing a repetition of some of these sounds. And sorry, it's not even just sounds, it's rhythm,
yes.
a rhythmic speak. And it's sort of complicated, but I would venture to say that it's a lot like what some people would say is res speak. Res speak is now, it's recognized by a lot of Native American tribes. I think it came from the Navajo experience, because that part of the Southwest is serious reservation territory. Navajo,
yes.
Hopi, and they have and they're, you know, very open and honest about the fact that we have res speak, and we have a language, colloquial vocabulary that is res speak. But it's not just the words, it's the way they're spoken.
What would an example of res speak be?
Gosh, I was just watching a funny video yesterday, a guy who was sort of sharing with people what some res speak was.
Yes.
A buckle bunny. But you know what, that's just a slang term. What's interesting to me is the rhythmic sort of what we would call a choppy way of speaking, which
mm-hmm.
I'm replicating right now. It's sort of short, the vowels are short, the R's are sort of hard and clipped. It's like the face doesn't move very much. Now, mind you, I'm not reflecting anybody's speech in particular right now, but rhythmically, it does. They don't. The res speak that I've heard doesn't lie down in the vowels the way I'm doing right now.
Yes.
And again, what is so similar about that, and the Yupik Eskimo elders that I've heard speaking, is that choppy, quick way of speaking, and among elders too, I'll add, also characterized by a real softness in the voice, not very loud speech, and not very quick. I'm speaking very generally, of course.
Of course.
But I do notice some patterns, and having elders speak somewhat more slowly and quietly is definitely, I mean, Eskimo will be the first to admit it, at least the folks that I've known. So, you know, I'm. It's funny, you're probably sensing I'm a little uncomfortable, because I feel like even though I've been doing this for a little while, I feel like I don't know anything.
Yes.
You know, I feel like, and in many ways I have to say, because I'm not of Native descent, I'm almost not even qualified to speak too thoroughly, but maybe that's not fair. You spend some time learning about something, you talk about it, and that's what we're doing.
Yes.
But I think it's important to say that I'm not coming from a place of deep knowledge because of my family or life of experiences,
yes.
but some poignant and meaningful experiences for me. And I'm starting to put those pieces together.
You're going through a process of exploration, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm curious about what are some of the things that you try to maintain in terms of a focus when you're doing this work?
Yeah, well, there are a few. I think the main thing is I'm always really clear about why I'm doing this and not why I'm doing this. As I'm sure you are when you ask someone if you can record them. I'm really clear about the fact that I'm not a scientist and that I'm not an activist, and that I'm interested actually in helping actors avoid stereotype by giving them actual samples of real people that an actor can choose to use as a basis for character or not. I'm also really with the Native American communities I've interacted with, because I'm Anglo, I have to be very conscientious of the ways that one has access to members of tribes, which is a very discreet thing, meaning I can't just go to a Native American community center and say, "Hey, everybody, I'm from Chicago." You know, you can imagine. I have to get entree to communities. So I have to meet somebody quietly and maybe find out if there are elders in the village, or maybe there are other Anglos in the village who have cachet with Native community members. So I have to, I just have to be very, I use the word discreet, but maybe that's not the best word. I have to be very sensitive and very gentle in my ways. I have to admit, having spent time in Alaska, that definitely, it gave me some cred.
Yes.
Because at least I know a little bit about something somewhere.
Yes.
And that certainly helped when I was in Anchorage speaking with people. And I knew some people. It's been much harder for me. I think I mentioned this to you before. It's been much harder for me to get access to some tribes here on the East Coast because I have no connection.
Yes.
So it takes time. It takes writing letters. It takes sort of scouring the internet and sort of finding out who's doing what. And
right.
Is there anybody there that might do something that I do or that might be interested in helping me or... Yeah.
Have you had any experience where you actually tried to just go up to the community center and say, "Hey, I'd like to record some people." And what happened?
I did.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.